Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 283 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I have spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of Japanese gardens. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, and space. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. We start this week's show, which focuses on soil and trees, among other things, with a recent article by Madeline Buiano, published and updated on February 21st in Martha Stewart Living, 10 Fastest Growing Trees That Promise Privacy and Beauty Without the Weight. Trees are a beautiful addition to any landscape, no matter the size. Whether you only have room for a small focal tree or you want to layer several varieties for maximum impact, no garden design is complete without at least one tree. The only downside? Trees often take decades to reach full maturity. But it doesn't have to be that way. Many varieties grow up to 5 feet tall in a single year, filling your landscape without a long waiting period. Ahead, we're sharing several fast-growing trees that experts say offer shade, privacy, color, and so much more to any outdoor space. Contributions come from Allison Futerall, owner and buyer of the Crimson Historical Rarities, Mark Canny, director of landscape and horticulture at Arbor Day Farm, Nason Thorne, a horticulturist at Handy Flowers in the United Kingdom, and Samuel Davis, a horticulturist and CEO of London Gardeners. 1. Crepe myrtle. Crepe myrtle, Lagerstroemia, encompasses a range of perennial, deciduous, and evergreen trees and shrubs that are perfect for small landscapes. Plants from this genus are recognized by their beautiful blooms that fill gardens with interest from summer to fall. There are many varieties available, allowing you to choose the size that works best in a beautiful accent color to add to your garden, says Allison Futerall, owner and buyer of Crimson Horticultural Rarities. Zones 7 to 9, size 3 to 20 feet tall, and 3 to 20 feet wide. Care requirements: full sun, well-draining soil, moderate watering. 2. Peach tree. While it may take a few years to bear fruit, peach trees, Prunus persica, are fast-growing and put on a beautiful show while you wait. Peach trees produce showy pink flowers in spring, filling your yard with seasonal color. These trees need proper attention to grow to their full potential. Pruning is essential, as is being diligent against pests. Zones 4 to 10, size 15 to 25 feet tall and 15 to 25 feet wide. Care requirements: full sun, moist, acidic, well-draining soil, moderate watering. 3. Flowering cherry tree. Flowering cherry trees, Prunus cerulata, are one of the most highly anticipated plants to see in full bloom every spring by people with and without a green thumb. This tree is famous for its floral decoration in the season of spring and the outstanding colors that appear in the season of autumn, says horticulturist Nathan Thorne. They are perfect for giving a garden a little more color. One downside to flowering cherry trees is that they're usually short-lived, having an average lifespan of 15 to 20 years. Zones 5 to 8, size 15 to 25 feet tall and 15 to 25 feet wide. Full sun, well-draining soil, moderate watering. 4. Weeping willow. Weeping willow, Salix babylonica, is beloved for its beautiful arching branches that add a touch of whimsy to any landscape. The best part? You don't have to wait long for this tree to reach maturity. But keep in mind that because of this tree's rapid growth, it has weak wood that can easily crack or break. Pruning helps prevent this, and the branches are relatively easy to propagate. Zones 6 to 8, size 30 to 40 feet tall and 30 to 40 feet wide. Care requirements: full to part sun, acidic, moist soil, moderate watering. Number 5. Tulip poplar. Tulip poplar, Liriodendron tulipifera, gets its name from its attractive greenish-yellow flowers that resemble tulip blooms. It's a native deciduous tree that can grow quite tall in the right growing conditions. It needs watering on a regular basis, especially in its young years, says Samuel Davis, a horticulturist and CEO of London Gardeners. This poplar type benefits from applying a thick mulch layer to keep the soil moisture at an ideal level and ensure proper soil temperature. Zones 4 to 9, size 80 to 120 feet tall, 30 to 60 feet wide. Care requirements: full sun, well-draining, slightly acidic soil, moderate watering. 6. Eastern redbud. Eastern redbud, Cercis canadensis, is a fast-growing ornamental tree that looks beautiful as a focal point in small landscapes or as an understory tree in large ones. Regular watering is a must during dry periods and yearly pruning to maintain shape and remove dead branches, says Davis. In early spring, it gives way to beautiful clusters of pink flowers that are beloved by pollinators. Zones 4 to 9, size 20 to 30 feet tall and 25 to 35 feet wide. Care requirements: full sun to partial shade, fertile clay or sandy soil, regular watering. 7. Sweet gum tree. American sweet gum, liquid amber styraciflua, is often found growing in wet river bottoms, swamps prone to flooding, and drier uplands. The very signature glossy green leaves offer a show from spring as they emerge to the spectacular fireworks display in fall with colors of red and orange, says Mark Canny, director of landscape and horticulture at Arbor Day Farm. It has a shallow root system and should be planted in spring to give the roots time to recover from the stress of transplanting. Zones 5 to 10, size 60 to 100 feet tall and 40 to 50 feet wide. Care requirements: full sun to partial shade, moist, well-draining soil, moderate watering. This tree produces spiky, gumball-sized fruits that fall on the ground between December and April that can be troublesome to homeowners. 8. Crabapple tree. Crabapple trees, Prunus, are perfect for smaller yards and gardens, adding a cheerful note thanks to their pink flowers. While these trees have unparalleled curb appeal, they can be prone to diseases, including powdery mildew and fire blight. To avoid these concerns, consider growing a variety that is disease resistant. Zones 3 to 8, size 6 to 30 feet tall and 6 to 30 feet wide. Care requirements: full sun, well-draining, slightly acidic soil, moderate watering. 9. Bruce spruce. Bruce spruce, Picea pungens, also known as Colorado spruce, is native to the central Rocky Mountains. Because of its native climate, it does better in cooler regions and won't survive in hot, humid areas. While it needs consistent moisture when it is first planted, it will become relatively drought-tolerant as it matures. Zones 3 to 7, size 30 to 60 feet tall and 10 to 20 feet wide. Care requirements: full sun, well-draining soil, moderate watering. And 10, paper birch. Paper birch, Betula papyrifera, offers multiple seasons of interest and is often grown for its white exfoliating bark that turns yellow in autumn. In spring, small flowers appear, followed by cone-like fruits in late summer. Birch trees are considered a pioneer species, meaning they grow quickly when they're young. Zones 2 to 7, size 50 to 70 feet tall, and 25 to 50 feet wide. Care requirements: partial sun, loam or sandy, well-draining soil, moderate watering. An article by Madeline Buiano, published in Martha Stewart, and updated on February 21st, 10 fast-growing trees that promise privacy and beauty without the wait. We bring our old friend Robin Lane Fox into the discussion about trees. His column, published on the 14th of February, Diversity and Inclusion? We Need More of It in Our Tree Planting. British hawthorn, oak, and birch enrich the landscape, but so do varieties hailing from as far away as China and Chile. Tree planting has never had a better press. Carbon capture, climate change, rural stewardship, responsible farming, these fine causes have all raised its social profile. As a gardener, I engage with it yearly in February, when trees are still dispatched from specialist nurseries with strong bare roots lifted from open ground. Planting is possible, even enjoyable, in the interludes between days of rain before the trees come into leaf. This happy work makes me realize how gardeners and public planters have different priorities. Local councils signal eco-virtue by proclaiming the number of trees they will plant in a year, announcing targets that they aim to hit as if with an arrow from the bow of William Tell. Gardeners want one or two fine specimen trees. If they have broad acres, not small urban havens, they may also want an arboretum. Regrettably, cities and local authorities no longer plant arboretums, those havens for ornamental trees collected all over the globe from China to Peru. Councils and public authorities are arboreal nativists, polemically committed to planting nothing but native trees. Gardeners want flowers and beauty and look for them whether or not they originate in Britain. Alongside roads and batches of new housing, public planters cram in saplings of hawthorn and beech, English oak, and those excessive beneficiaries of the nativist agenda, silver birch. Thickly planted about a foot apart, the majority of these saplings are projected to die long before semi-maturity. In the past, town planters used to plant arboreta of specimen trees from faraway habitats in urban parks and public spaces, ornamenting the landscape and treating the public to beauty and unfamiliarity. Arboretum of recently found trees from China and Chile and modern Hyde Park? Dream on. In his new book, The Tree Hunters, Thomas Pakenham addresses this divergence in the same clear style that made his Meetings with Remarkable Trees a bestseller. He tells many tales of bold collectors before 1920 who went to gather seeds of trees in the wild and bring them back for cultivation in Britain. He ventures beyond the usual stories of the usual heroes. He then puts the cult of the arboretum at the center of what he rightly calls the transformation of our landscape. I had never joined the two so clearly before. He has form here. 20 years ago, overruling his wife Valerie, he began an arboretum of trees grown from seed he had collected in Tibet and China. It has flourished. What is an arboretum? a collection of non-native trees, I would say, chosen as specimens for diversity, beauty, and unusual features. Pakenham is more strict. He defines it as a documented collection of trees planted for scientific study or enjoyment. He wants to distinguish arboreta from woodland gardens, a distinction I would draw by excluding ornamental underplantings and flowerbeds from a true arboretum. If aging owners lose the documents that listed their planting, does the result cease to be an arboretum in their heirs' hands? It has become undocumented, but surely retains its claim to the name. Pakenham's research into the first arboreta in Britain and Ireland has taught him that their history is shadowy. Even among the shadows, I'm sure that Shakespeare never saw an arboretum in the strict sense of the term. Pakenham traces their beginnings back to the 1660s to the two Tradescants, father and son, and John Evelyn, a no one-sided nativist, and to Henry Compton, Bishop of London, perhaps the last such bishop to be an apostle of rare trees, an initiator of a truly useful mission, one to bring seeds in from North America. The word arboretum had simply meant a grove of trees, but by the 1760s it began to be applied to special collections, spearheaded by those in royal ownership that later became the Botanic Garden at Kew. Compton failed to become Archbishop of Canterbury. Pakenham remarks that in his case, and no doubt that of many others, a collection of trees was an antidote for disappointment. He stops his book long before the 1960s, but arboreta have certainly not ceased. Public planters have abandoned them, except in botanic gardens, but private owners have planted superb examples. They include the great collection of oaks at Cheviotthorne Barton in Devon, assembled by Michael Heathcote Amory, and the tree planting in Jonathan Ruffer's major restoration of Auckland Castle and Bishop's Palace in County Durham. Each ranks as a successful investor, never toppled by the market to leave it in disappointment. At Thenford in Northamptonshire, Michael Heseltine, the doyen of Tory ex-statesmen, has spent decades laying out a big arboretum in his massively impressive garden. Outsiders might mistake this one, at least as an antidote to disappointment, as Heseltine's prime ministership remains one of the great might-have-beens of the 1990s. But those present at the launch, age 91, of his new book, From Acorns to Oaks, know better. Semi-retirement gave him more leisure. It did not turn him to a new antidote. His impassioned collection of trees began far earlier in his career, when he had started by believing that a hornbeam was a dance they did in the Navy in Georgian times. His book covers far more than his gardening. It includes his current blueprint to rebuild Britain and his final discoveries about the degrees of official untruth and cover-up used against him during the Westland Affair of 1985-86, that crucial dispute over the commissioning of military helicopters that led him to resign from Thatcher's cabinet. His arboretum benefited, but it had begun already. Nativist tree planters justly denounced the importing of mature trees from foreign sources and the pests and diseases they may bring in by accident. The foreign trees introduced to British arboreta were mostly grown from collected seed and then propagated for sale quite safely in Britain itself. Nativists also protest that non-native trees do not foster bees, insects, or biodiversity. These interrelations are all complex and are less studied for foreign trees so far than native ones. Meanwhile, ivy and nettles are basic supports for many butterflies and insects, but grow as well among non-native trees as under natives only. As a gardener, I have just been moving a sorbus. It is not a native rowan or service tree, but a pink-berried sorbus hoopensis from China. Every year, its stale-scented flowers are visited by British insects, and then its berries are consumed with glee by British birds in autumn. In my tall Italian alder trees, I have thrushes nesting and bees too. Beside them, I have been planting yet another winter-flowering cherry, the wonderful Prunus subhirtella, autumnalis from China. It remains my top tree for prolonged beauty, never more so than in this wet and gray winter, when it began to flower in late November and is still at its finest, with more to come. British blue tits do not only feed on British blackthorn, a scruffy native prunus, they also feed on the insects and aphids and peck at the buds on winter flowering cherries of Asian origin. As for silver birches, the whitest and loveliest barks and trunks are on Betula jacamontii, at home in the Himalayas, and on its varieties selected by nurserymen. They are far lovelier than birches native to Britain, those great invaders after the Ice Age. Do not be one-sided. Bring back global arboreta and break down the barriers of prejudice that keep them out of cities' public spaces. An article and cri de coeur from Robin Lane Fox, published in the Financial Times of London on the 14th of February. Diversity and inclusion, we need more of it in our tree planting. We turn now to an examination of soil in an article by Sarah Langford, published on January 24th in Country Life magazine. Were the soil a jungle, the worm would be its elephant. Why everything you thought about soil is probably wrong. Did you know that soil contains 59% of all the Earth's species? As an exhibition at Somerset House, exploring its vital role in our planet's future, prepares to open, Sarah Langford argues that it is high time soil became fashionable. In the mid-1880s, the prevailing view was that soil was disintegrated rock modified by weather. It was inert, unchanging, and unchangeable. But in experiments which lasted 40 years, the naturalist Charles Darwin decided they were wrong. Soil was not static. It was both full of life and ever-changing. Darwin observed that when dead plants were eaten and passed through a worm, they formed a cast, many times nutritionally richer than the ground around it. This formed a layer of fertile humus, a skin that protected the earth. Worms, Darwin concluded, did not merely move soil around. They made it. They were one of few animals which have played so important a part in the history of the world, not least because the soil they created protected and preserved every object not liable to decay, which is dropped on the surface of the land. Archaeologists, he cautioned, ought to be grateful to worms. Much of Darwin's work was ignored in favor of one of his contemporaries, Justus von Liebig, who concluded something else entirely. Discounting soil humus as having any value, he considered soils a storage bin for nutrients, specifically nitrogen, potassium, and phosphate. All plants, without exception, exhaust the soil, each of them in their own way, of the conditions for their reproduction, he wrote, although anyone with a thriving pot plant may disagree. His law of the minimum warned that if one nutrient was missing, it would reduce a plant's ability to take up others. His barrel theory offered a simple solution. A nutrient taken off in a crop could simply be added to the soil. Liebig was thought to have later recanted, but by then the paradigm had stuck. It would do so for the next century, influenced by a series of world and scientific events. When Britain entered the Second World War, it realized our reliance on food imports left it vulnerable. The legacy of the removal of the Corn Laws, a world war and the Great Depression, had left farmland abandoned. The Dig for Victory effort increased the arable land by 50%. In 6 short years, the country went from importing 70% of its food to making it. Work by American plant breeder Norman Borlaug developed high-yielding wheat varieties. Grown with newly available artificial fertilizer and pesticides, the Green Revolution saw production boom. 4 decades after the end of the war, Western Europe's overproduction had to be stockpiled in concrete silos. 17 million tons of grain, more than anyone or anything could eat. This overproduction continues to this day. We produce enough food globally to feed 3 billion more people than exist, with up to 40% being lost or wasted. We are now beginning to understand the true cost of so much plenty. Intensive agriculture, with its tillage and use of artificial fertilizers and chemicals, which deplete rather than feed the soil, have left the UN declaring one-third of the globe's soils to be degraded. In a world that grows 95% of its food in soil, this degradation undermines our very existence. For now we know that the soil is alive, containing 59% of all the Earth's species, making it, according to a recent study, the singular most biodiverse habitat on Earth. A teaspoon of living soil contains more creatures than there are people existing on the planet. Indeed, only 10% of the regionally specific creatures living within it have been identified. Although earthworms are part of it, were the soil a jungle, the worm would be its elephant. They live alongside billions of creatures that spend their lives eating, excreting, dying and reproducing, and in doing so, continually changing the soil's properties in an ancient symbiotic relationship with plants that now seems to hold the key to both the health of the soil, the plant, and when we eat it, us. Plants work with soil so both can survive. For beneath the ground, a deal is done. Plants exude between 11 and 40% of the liquid carbon they make during photosynthesis to feed themselves through their roots. This is exchanged with some of the microbes and bacteria living in the soil in return for the minerals and nutrients, macro and micro, that the plants need to stay healthy. Plant and microbe are joined together by a vast network of fungi, so that a plant attacked by a pest or a fungal disease can dial up exactly the microbe or bacteria it needs. Unbroken, this giant underground telephone network will stretch for miles. This relationship between the amount of life in the soil and the diversity of plants that feed it mean that, if plants are removed, soil can no longer live. Much like Rozier's complete course of agriculture, which, despite Darwin's work, declared worms pests that needed to be eliminated from the soil well into the early 20th century, a lucrative agri-industry has become invested in selling us the nutrients thought to be missing from the soil. The soil in which we produce our food has become a material to which nutrients are added, not an essential part of the growing process. Failing to understand it has come at a cost to us all. In the UK, we lose 2.2 million tons of topsoil each year, and despite all the pesticides and fertilizers, we have not eliminated crop disease or pests. Although chemicals may win the battle, nature wins the war. But times are changing, and not only within science. For in a world where advertising, not argument, holds the greatest sway, it was high time soil became fashionable. And, at last, it has. Nearly 100 years after the co-founder of the Soil Association, Lady Eve Balfour, was called a crank for writing The Living Soil, celebrities, chefs, and musicians are putting their hands, or at least their money, into the earth. Books by regenerative rancher Gabe Brown are bestsellers. Netflix is streaming Kiss the Ground, and cinemas 6 inches of soil. Buses drive through central London, urging urbanites to save our soils, as model Arizona Muse founds a charity, Dirt, supporting biodynamic farming projects around the globe. All this is set to a backdrop of one of the biggest changes in UK agriculture in generations. Public subsidies for land have been replaced with public money for public good. The government's sustainable farming incentive places restoration of soil at its heart. Farmers can choose from a mix-and-match suite of 23 different ways to not only prevent soils from degrading, but regenerate them. Along with this new attention comes opportunity. Our soils store more than 3 times the amount of carbon than is in the atmosphere. Last year, research found that sequestering 1% more carbon in half the world's degraded soils would capture enough to keep the world within 1.5% of global heating. Meanwhile, for anyone finding their houses uninsurable after repeated flash flooding, soils may also hold the key. UK soils alone can hold an estimated 130 trillion liters of water, more than all our rivers and lakes combined. Andy Neal at the Rothamsted Research says that every 1% increase in soil organic carbon equates to a water-holding capacity increase of 354,000 liters a hectare to a depth of 30 centimeters, more than 5 swimming pools worth of rain in only 1 hectare, 2.5 acres. Restoring your soils and rain goes into the field, not our villages or rivers. An article by Sarah Langford, a Suffolk-based writer and former barrister. She is also the author of Rooted, How Regenerative Farming Can Change the World, Soil the World at Our Feet. The exhibition is at Somerset House in London until April 13th. This article was published on the 24th of January in Country Life magazine. Were the soil a jungle, the worm would be its elephant. We close this week with another article by Robin Lane Fox. This one published on the 24th of January. England's great Arcadian gardens are its natural capital. A new book illustrates that far from being pastoral fantasies wasting land, money, and energy, they are a valuable cultural export, part of the country's enduring soft power. England's green and pleasant land is at risk from many angles: a changing climate, house building targets, and a forest of pylons to transmit renewable energy. It needs responsible zoning if its charms are to be passed on to posterity. Economists belittle concerns about them as the fantasies of pastoral romantics. Fantasies have power and can add value too. At last, a concept of natural capital is being pressed on economists as one to take into account. Tim Richardson's The English Landscape Garden, 40 pounds, Francis Lincoln, publisher, centers on natural capital at its man-made best. I say man-made because the Georgian patriarchy's English landscape was a male creation. Richardson presents the enduring work of men who were dreaming of Arcadia, his subtitle in 18th century Britain. Some of them were city merchants, cits. Others were politicians, including chancellors of the Exchequer, whose careers ended abruptly. One of them, John Aislaby, shaped a superb garden at Studley Royal, partly as a riposte to critics who accused him of helping the South Sea bubble to burst. What would their modern successors' landscape gardens look like? All those green acres, those uninhabited buildings, those unproductive lakes, those depreciating statues, and the absence, even the removal, of housing for the poor. Classical references and poetry often underlie these landscapes' features. No wonder modern economists write them off. Nonetheless, they became a cultural export, part of England's enduring soft power. They imprinted emulation of the English garden on landed classes in Europe and then the U.S. Economists might argue for sweeping them into their ha-has and covering them in houses to galvanize growth. Richardson's excellent book intensifies my hold on the opposite view. His subject has often been studied, but he chooses well, writes judiciously, and presents detailed recent research. The photos by Clive Bournesnell are generally excellent, too, marking the book out from predecessors. The gardens are ones with vistas, lakes, and sculpted and built features. There were flower gardens galore in the Georgian period, but they existed around much smaller properties or in lesser parts of big ones with parks. They were not compared with pastoral Arcadia, but landscapes were, as audiences of Tom Stoppard's play Arcadia well know. Richardson's 20 choices are enough to sustain years of happy visiting and walking. I hope the publishers will issue smaller-sized paperback edition that can be carried on travels and consulted with ease on site. His choices range from Devon to North Yorkshire and are a godsend for anyone planning an inland English holiday. In August, these landscape gardens are fascinating alternatives to overheated Sicily or destinations at risk to forest fires. Lord Burlington at Chiswick House, Capability Brown at Petworth, Blenheim, and Stowe. These set pieces are staples of all books on 18th century gardens, but Richardson includes others less familiar: St. Paul's Waldenbury in Hertfordshire, Hawkstone in Shropshire, Hackfall in North Yorkshire, and even Hafod in Ceredigion in Wales. I am one of those who have never seen Castle Hill in Devon, laid out for Lord Clinton from the 1720s onward. Others may not know Bramham Park in West Yorkshire, a masterpiece of formal and serpentine design in which I declare a family interest, or Rousham along the Cherwell River in Oxfordshire, near enough for me to visit and contemplate monthly. Richardson draws a line between gardens up to 1750 in which, he thinks, the owners were telling us something about themselves, and those after 1750, especially Capability Brown's, in which the hand of design was invisible. Indeed, the sights and aesthetic of gardens vary as the century advances. In its later decades, qualities of the picturesque and the sublime come onto the scene. A garden set in craggy scenery like Hafod in Wales has a different canvas to one like Stowe, set in broad acres of grassy park. The makers of these gardens like playful, ludic illusions. Richardson well brings out the way one's garden plan could play on another's. The garden's owners usually had strong political allegiances, Whig or Tory, as he aptly explains. Sometimes political allusions in their sculptures or groups of past worthies are fairly clear, but I think Richardson presses some of them too far. He well emphasizes the associations of Hercules with William III, whose monarchy was a touchstone of Whigs' sympathies. But I doubt if statues of Hercules always had those overtones, rather than the ones of labor and valor, opposites of love and luxury evoked elsewhere. One frequently evoked element was sex. It was evident in the various temples of Venus, where the sculptures of the goddess were based on the naked Venus of the Medici family in Florence's Uffizi, a salacious attraction for young aristocrats on a grand tour. At Stowe, imagery and inscriptions play on old age and failing sexual powers wittily, as Lord Cobham was indeed past his prime. At West Wickham, Francis Dashwood, aware of Stowe, laid out a physically suggestive mound of Venus, also a feature at Studley Royal. I am readier than Richardson to accept that there was substance to outsiders' claims that members of Francis Dashwood's Hellfire Club had orgies on the mound's cavern. At Castle Howard in Yorkshire, Richardson relates the statue of lovely Antinous, fabled lover of the Roman Emperor Hadrian, to the heroism of facing up to failure and irrelevance, a fitting message for the owner, Lord Carlisle, who had lost his political posting under Queen Anne. I totally disagree. Scholars have at last begun to discuss gay culture in the Georgian era, and Burlington and Carlisle are thought to have had a homoerotic sensibility. Antinous evoked it. How obtruse and remote, you may be thinking. Not at all. Richardson made me realize how many of these superb landscapes have been brilliantly restored in the past 40 years or so. Chiswick House, Bram Park in Yorkshire, Hestercombe in Somerset, and Painshill in Surrey being prime examples. Why? The rise of garden history propelled their rescue, not because of pastoral romanticism. Contemporaries value them as precious assets still. An article by Robin Lane Fox, published on the 24th of January in the Financial Times of London, England's great Arcadian gardens are its natural capital. That wraps up edition 283 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send us your comments at www.lars.org or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think about the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty and of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. They open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardeners, other gardens, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, or planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.